Thank you so much for coming. So today you are here for convincing parents, teachers, and other gatekeepers advocating for your comics collection. So first, before we get started, I have something that I need to say here. The Toronto Comic Arts Festival would like to acknowledge that the land in which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg, Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations, the Haudenosaunee, and the Huron-Wendat, and that Indigenous people have lived and cared for this land for more than 15,000 years. This territory is covered by the Dish With One Spoon Wampum Belt Treaty. Today, Toronto is still the home to many Indigenous people from across Turtle Island. We acknowledge that settlers on the land directly benefit from the process of colonization. In recognition of our gathering on these lands for TCAF 2018, the Festival of the Day has made a donation to the Native Child and Family Services of Toronto. We look forward to increasing our support and programs for Indigenous creators in the years to come. As well, programming at TCAF 2018 is sponsored by Seneca College Faculty of Communication, Art, and Design. TCAF would also like to thank our presenting sponsors, The Big Island, Little Island Comics, and Toronto Public Library. Thanks to our media sponsor, Now Magazine, and we also recognize the support of the Canada Council for the Arts, the Ontario Arts Council, and the Toronto Arts Council. Thank you for that. So today, my name is Scott Robbins, and I am a Children's Services Specialist for Toronto Public Library. I'm going to be your moderator today. And today, we're going to be talking about advocacy when it comes to comics and graphic novels. So the first thing I'd like to do is just to go along and introduce the panelists, and then afterwards I would like the panelists to kind of like tell a little bit of kind of what they do, what their job title is, and talk about a time where you kind of came up against resistance to comics and how you kind of just a story about how you came up against resistance to comics in your particular area of expertise. So first, on my right here, is Michelle Miller.
Thank you. I don't think I need that. We teach in big rooms. I'm a lecturer at the Ontario College of Art and Design University here in Toronto, and I teach in the English department. And I teach a course that is specifically on comics to university students, many of whom are really primed to read and often create their own comics. So in my current job, I don't really experience that much resistance from students, but my PhD, it happens, but my PhD is in education, and so most of the resistance that I faced in and around comics came from deciding to study comics, particularly within, is it okay to talk, do you want me to tell the story now?
Yeah, okay.
Particularly in within education. So oftentimes I was working with people who are teacher educators, or I was talking to teachers, and a lot of the resistance that I found was around whether or not comics were texts that adults should read or could learn anything from reading. So anytime I started to talk about my research about comics, people would say, "Well, what grade level is that for?" And I would say, it's for you. Like, I think you should read this because it will make you a better teacher at this, or I think you should read this because it will make you a better person, or I think you should read this because it's a really good book. And so a lot of the resistance that I noticed had to do with people within education wanting to acknowledge the instrumental like use of comics for promoting literacy for other people. And so that many teachers who I worked with would say, oh yeah, I always get all of my students to read comics, I buy all the comics, my library is full of comics, and I would say, oh, well, what's your favorite comic? And they'd say, oh, I never read one. I just read the write-ups. So that's my outsider-insider.
So next to Michelle, we have Lee Hurwitz.
Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I can.
So, I'm a school outreach librarian at Brooklyn Public Library in Brooklyn, New York. And am I the only non-Canadian?
Well, you're
not. Well, but you're. And so, what that means is that it's my full-time job to support K-12 schools, of various sorts in Brooklyn, the whole community, students, teachers and administrators, parents and caregivers. That can look like a lot of different kinds of things, professional development, research lessons, book talking. My areas of focus tend to be around gender and sexuality education, so I'm trying to do more of that, and also comics education as well, both creating them and consuming them. And, you know, in thinking about this, I would say that what I experience is less outright rejection of comics and more just lack of awareness or lack of understanding about what kinds of things are there. When you say comics to a lot of teachers or parents, they have a particular idea of what that is in mind, and they really don't know the breadth of what is available right now. And I think, so part of what I feel my job is to let them know how many different kinds of things there are for so many different kinds of readers. And I found that once I do that, it like opens up their brain a little bit more to make space for the idea of things that really could be valuable or worthwhile for them. Yeah.
Cool. Now, next to Lee, we have Fatma Viraj.
Hello, everyone. I've got the big voice, too. I am a teacher librarian at Branksome Hall, just around the corner from here, all girls. I'm in the JK, so junior kindergarten to grade 6 level, so, and previously I was in the public school board, and I was in a middle school library. I think, for myself, I don't really have as much resistance against them because I've been using them for so long in the library, and they're actually the very first shelf when you come into the space that you can see them. And so I will say, though, the resistance that I probably see the most is probably, it's actually happened in the last probably month. It's grade 3, I'm going to say, where I have a lot of my younger, they're all attracted to the graphic novels and the comics. Like, they're just like, they're visually, it's, that's what they want. And when they come into the space, that's what they take out. And then, so then you hear from a teacher or a parent saying, I want them to start reading novels. And so you're like, well, they are reading, right? Like, it's actually harder to read a graphic novel than it is sometimes to read a straight through story. And so that's where you're trying to shift their minds a little bit. And it was interesting because I was at school this morning before I came over here, and I was talking to our curriculum coordinator, and she said, you know what's interesting? She said, our students just came back from testing, and there's some information around media literacy. And she says, our grade 3 students, their marks in media literacy were up here because of that visual piece to it. And she says, you tell them the graphic novels are where it's at. Like, so we will be using, so that's where you're using some data now to actually prove to parents and to the teachers to say, you know what, we're not supposed to be shutting this down. We should be encouraging it and continuing it through the older grades and with everyone.
And our last speaker is Amy Wright.
Hey everyone, you may recognize me from earlier, in which myself and my colleague did the keynote.
I don't mean to interrupt, but your mic's not on, so you can either continue to hold it.
So how can you hear me now? So I was working in New York for a few years doing school outreach, so likely working with schools, and through that I did a lot of professional development with educators. My current position, I'm a manager in Edmonton Public Library in Western Canada, and again, working with schools, a lot of professional development, and also the building of special collections for schools. Probably the biggest, oh gosh, so many stories. I think one of the things is, again, around literacy. We hear a lot of, you know, comics, quote, aren't real reading, or comics are stepping stones for reading. Neither of those statements are factually true. We have a lot of evidence-based research that actually says the opposite. It's not that they aren't stepping stones to reading, but they are just reading, number one, and they are real reading. And, like, you know, people being confident about their reading is actually the biggest indicator of student success. One of the things, though, that's also fascinating is how much, I think, resistance comes from sometimes our own colleagues in administration, even just around the idea of professional development. I'm very active with the American Library Association around doing professional development around comics and graphic novels, and one of the things we always ask is how many people are here on their free time and how many people are here on their work time. So I'm going to ask you guys, How many people are here on their free time?
Okay, that's good. There's, okay.
How many people are here on work time? Okay, so that's awesome. That doesn't always happen. Oftentimes, it may only be like 25% of the room that's actually here on work time. When I was in New York, one of the things I even found was interesting, this is coinciding with the advent of the Common Core State Standards in the States. So these are trying to get instructional standards used pretty much, you know, for better or for worse in all different states and educational institutions. It's recommended educational practice. And one of the biggest things was this was also around the time that March, John Lewis's and Derrida and Nate Powell's March, you know, Lee Walton is here from Top Shelf, March got added to a lot of curriculum. So I remember going into a PD being like, oh, well, I know that March is in your curriculum. And they're like, yeah, so we can't teach comics. And I was like, what? Like, you know, the Common Core State Standards. And I was like, okay, I'm not a teacher. So I was like, I'm going to read the Common Core State Standards. And you know what they actually say for grades 6 to 12? That you should teach using multiple formats, including graphic novels. So when I started to do PDs, I started including screenshots of the Common Core State Standards and screenshots of the New York City curriculum in which it said that March was a required reading. So I think sometimes even from our own colleagues and stuff, I think there's still a lot of fear or just like sort of a lack of knowledge. And I know a lot of times it's prep time and support, and there's a lot of different factors. But I think sometimes we even don't build each other up and we don't think about our collections. Whether they're comics or audiobooks or anything that's quote non-traditional, it's just about building accessible collections that actually reflect the students and the people we see in our libraries and really encouraging people.
Thanks, Amy. So Amy actually sent me this cartoon when we were kind of discussing about the things that we're going to talk about today. And I think it's like a perfect sort of like lead into our discussion today. So it says here, question from the kids librarian panel, what to say when a parent won't let their kid check out any comics? So Margaret Scott said, firstly, secondly, you can cite studies about the benefits of reading comics on the brain. Vera Roskell, who's going to be here this weekend, comics can be so important for reluctant readers. We should never discourage kids from reading. And then, so this cartoon was actually written and drawn by Melanie Gilman. And they say, and if the parent won't budge, sneak that kid some web comic racks. Which I thought was like wonderfully subversive. So my first question for the panel now is, what does advocacy, advocacy is one of those words that gets thrown out a lot, where people are like, I'm an advocate. But what does advocacy actually look like? Like, what are the actual doings of advocacy in your day-to-day job?
It's even a lot of readers' advisory. So this question was an actual question during Emerald City Comic Con. Seattle Public Library hosts an all-day professional development event, and this is a question we probably get in the branch every day, certainly every week. Sometimes it's from the parents, sometimes it's from the educators, sometimes it's from the students. So I think sometimes advocacy is also finding that delicate balance of not shooting somebody down, but also really supporting reading and just saying, well, you know, why don't we find a few different things? We get a lot of questions about reading levels, and so there's a lot of education. So I think trying to build people up, but you're all sort of always being an advocate, and sometimes it's having sort of hard conversations, you know, with parents, even about reading, and being like, well, you know, actually, blah, 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 blah. So I like to always have an elevator pitch at all times, works out, and different talking points about reading or even just examples, you know, of people who, quote, we read comic books growing up and they're doing pretty okay, like the country of France or Japan. So.
You know, I'm a parent, and I'm a book nerd, and so the thing that I am often talking to my friends who are also parents, I talk to them about books, about what our kids might be reading, about what we have in our library, and my kid is a real bookworm, and she loves comics. And so I'm often talking to other parents who want the best for their kids, who want their kids to do well in school, because even I think that like concerns about literacy reflect a desire to help kids be successful, and I think a total misunderstanding of literacy. Especially in 2018, when visual literacy is as or more important for young people even than narrative literacy. If you think about what it looks like to read online, That's you need visual literacy to be able to make sense of what's happening, if something is news or fake news. Visual literacy offers these kinds of markers. But so I talk to my friends all the time about, you know, like, we're looking at this, or we're looking at this, and we're looking at this. And oftentimes people say, yeah, but how many of those are books? Because they know that I teach comics. And I'm like, come on.
They're all books.
Yeah. Even if they're happening online, they're books. Yeah. And so for me, I have these ugh moments where I'm like, oh, I'm going to make nobody read a comic ever again because I'm going to be such a jerk.
Yeah.
I worry about that. So I think it's true that it is a balance of like recognizing that the people who have these anxieties have real anxieties about how to prepare their children to live in the world. And still they're not right. And they need support. You heard it from me.
I think it also goes back to the whole idea that we read them as well.
Yeah.
And that we're practicing it. And I'm thinking about, I've been very fortunate in my life. My mom has always bought me books, and she always bought me like comic books, and now she buys me graphic novels, right? And I kind of joke about the fact that it started with Archie Comics when I was a kid, but now she's like, oh, this was the top 10. And I'm like, oh, Mom, you're so cute. Thank you. And so she'll, but I read it, and then even in the library as well, is that the students and that they come in and they're like, oh, you're reading that right now? And you're like, yeah. I said, what'd you think? Oh, tell me what you think when you finish it. And then they'll tell you what their favorite part is, which usually like reveals what happens in the end. But it's all good. But then, I'm thinking about even advocacy then, the students, they're the easy ones. The kids are easy. It's when their parents come in and they're like, what do you think about this one? Like, is it okay? And you're like, yeah, it was great. I loved it. And they're like, you read it? And you're like, yeah. And so it's that whole thing as well, like where you say, read it. Like, give it a try too, because then you have the same conversations with your kids, and you don't have to necessarily talk about a novel that you read. You actually could talk about another text that you've read. So there's those elements that happen. And I think just to go with that as well, and just kind of remind them, there was that time where we used to like get the newspaper at home, like the actual physical paper, and we read the comics. Right? And your parents read the comics. Everybody read the comics. So we just need to start recognizing that maybe it's not coming in the Saturday paper every day or every week, that we're using other texts to get to the same sort of stories. Just different ways.
Yeah, I would say I second everything that everyone has said. And I think also thinking about the way that you treat comics in your space and... I think you advocate for comics by having a really strong collection and knowing your collection well. And I also think that you advocate for them by giving people examples of whether you are involved with them or not, schools or classrooms or instances of other trusted professionals. Other parents, other teachers that are really open to comics and like what that kind of success could look like, because I think that maybe puts them at ease and it kind of normalizes it a little bit. So not isolating comics in your collection or in your space, making them just a natural part of any display or any, if you're making a list for somebody, for a teacher, or yeah, just it's just a normal thing. There's comics in there.
You know what I've said before? You know what Francois Mouly says about comics to the other parents? And I'm like, you know, she's the art director of The New Yorker.
Yeah.
And she wrote this amazing introduction in a book on multimodal literature. I can't remember the title, but if you Google multimodal literature, Francois Mouly, her introduction is so great. And it's all about visual literacy. Mm-hmm. So if you find someone a little swanky.
Yeah.
And then...
What about with like fellow staff members? What does advocacy look like with fellows, with sort of internally?
A lot of the same. I mean, the big thing. I'll use March again, because March for me was sort of a tipping point, because I was like, if you're unwilling to accept that, I mean, yes, Andrew and Nate contributed, but that Congressman Don Lewis wrote a nonfiction book based on his life story, I'm a little concerned. But
I would sort of use sort of strong examples like this and also speak to people's area of interest. Like, I really do believe there's a comic for that. Like, I have a friend who's a poet, and I was like, oh, did you know Above the Dreamless Dead, which is poetry from World War I set to new illustrations. It was published just within the past 5 years, and it's a really nice articulation of sort of layered emotion and meaning, which poetry has, and also which really good illustrations have. So I try to always think about people's area of interest and sort of recommend along those lines, similarly with colleagues.
Anyone else?
One problem, I'll call it a problem, that we have at Brooklyn Public is there isn't a lot of, we have 60 branches, and there actually isn't a ton of consistency necessarily with how kids, teens, and adult comics are, whether they're interfiled with everything else or if they're separate or not. But a decision was made recently at our main branch to interfile the adult comic, the adult graphic novels, fiction. And I know that part of that decision was to cut down on theft, or they thought that it wouldn't. I said, but now people won't be able to find things. So I think this whole idea, too, of giving people an opportunity to discover things, which is what the library is for, is something that I also try to... Like, people, they have an idea of who's coming in to get comics, that they already know exactly what they're looking for, and it's like, well, no, we get some new comics readers. Yeah.
In your experience, what have you found are the main sort of resistors that come up again and again that people have against comics? What are the misconceptions or the things that people are like, well, you know, it's... graphic novels are graphics, so which means they're full of sex and drugs. And
they are. and it's good.
I think for myself, especially in a school library, is that that's what my students will consistently sign out. Like, they're constantly coming back, and I think that's where some people have issues with the fact that they may have had, you know, drama like 2 weeks ago, and then they've come back and they're getting drama again. And I think that's where...
Repeated reading.
It's the repeated reading. and you're kind of like thinking... I always say to them, I'm so envious that you have time to like go back to reading. I'm always going to the next book, and I'm always going forward, and I'm always thinking, I envy that time. And it's teaching, again, that whole idea of how many times did you read, you know, a book when you were a kid? You always went back and reread it. You always took time with it. And I think that's one of the issues, I think, with graphic novels in the library, is that they consistently, they're not, if you went back and looked at the history, which you're not supposed to do, but sometimes you do, and you see, you know exactly which ones they're taking out over and over and over again, and they've gone back to it.
I mean, why is repeated reading considered... by parents to be a bad thing?
Because literacy. Oh, they already know how to read this. They're just easy.
But then they don't understand that so much of the work of childhood is to figure out who are you. And part of figuring out who you are is sorry, I did study psychoanalysis. I did admit this morning. But it's cathexis, which is like finding these characters, finding these situations that help you understand who you are in the world, and then experience them again and again. And I think one of the most powerful things about a strong comics reading project in your own life is that they do beg rereadings. You can read a comic in an hour, and then you can read it 100 times, and it still can stay alive for you because of the visuality.
And you see something that you didn't see before. And I was even thinking... Even I was thinking about it as we were getting ready for this panel. You know, I paused a little bit more, right? It's not as like fast, and I discovered, I was like thinking, oh my goodness, this is what they do. You read forward for a bit, and then all of a sudden you look back and look at an image, and then you look at the words, and then you flip back a little bit, and then you go, that's what you want readers to be doing.
Yeah.
You don't want to be going so forward that you forget everything that's happened. And that's a gift, right? Just that whole idea that you're really thinking about it and immersing yourself to end trying to find understanding.
You know, I teach Fun Home every single term in my Connors class, and my students both like, some like it and some don't like it. Anyway, that and I, so I reread every book I teach. I reread. This is at university, okay? So we only have to teach once a week. So I reread every single book I teach, and my husband is always like, it's like, you don't have to reread this. I count it as part of my work. It's part of my work time that I have to do it. So I'm like rereading Fun Home, and I wrote a chapter of my dissertation on Fun Home, and I've taught it like probably 8 or 9 times now, and I've reread it every single time. And he was like, surely you do not need to read Fun Home again. Like, your students on their cursory first read of this text aren't going to notice a thing that you didn't see. You're prepared. I think because he wanted me to do the dishes or something. And then I was like, no, I need to reread it. And I couldn't have written it better, but I got into class, and the student made a presentation, and then in an offhand comment, she said something about an image that was so important that I had never seen before. In any of my readings, I totally missed it. And now every single time I read it, which I'll continue doing again every term, when I get to that part, I'll like get to have that feeling again. Of like surprise and excitement. I'm so proud of her.
I'm having like a moment here because I think this repeated reading discussion is, I think, is not something that has really been talked about a lot. But I think it's something that definitely comes up. I mean, for me at my library, it does come up. So I'm really happy that this is kind of, you know, come out here now.
Well, I think the other thing, I'm in the same panel at Emerald City. One of the moderators shared that at his daughter's school, the teacher had said to her, no, you can read comics once you finish with the real reading, because comics are candy and they're for dessert. So I think there is this notion that they are somehow like eating a cheeseburger or like eating, like drinking a milkshake. And so there's repeated anxiety about these repeat reads, because it's like, oh my gosh, they're eating junk food all the time.
To answer your question to you, though, about sex and violence, I think it's, you know, you have to address what I will say. I'm in a good position because I have support from my institution to say things like, you know, I will not, my career will not be harmed by me having these interactions with parents or teachers or whomever. But if you can, I think you have to address what it is that's really going on. So like, there's fear involved. I think for me, I don't say, oh, no, there actually isn't sex and violence. I might say, okay, so there is something in here that's sexual or violent. And, like, if it's queer, then if it's queer sex or there's something, being hinted at in that way, it's like, and that's okay, and this is why. Also, this book won an award. And, so instead of trying to backpedal and explain why it's innocent is to say, no, this is in here, and this is why, and it's because there are kids that are queer, and there are kids who have queer parents and caregivers, and yeah, it's totally fine.
So weird. There was always sex and violence in kids. Look, I grew up reading Fear Street, Christopher Pike book. I read all the smut that there would be, and I got a PhD. And, like, that was all there.
Yeah.
But there is this, like, weird, it's like, worry, is there sex, is there violence?
Right.
But
something with drama, for example, like, there is no sex in that book. There's two boys that have a crush on each other, or maybe kiss. To say, like, actually, no, you're, it's not, like, you should, I encourage you to read this. It's actually fine. I mean, I know, I read an article today in the New York Times about George by Alex Gino being challenged in Oregon, so it's like, but a whole bunch of 500 more people signed a petition to keep it in the... Then not. So, like, they're on the right side of history. It's fine.
I think that goes back to the whole idea is that it's those moments when people take just a panel out of the story or, you know, take a quote out of the space. And then that's where it becomes, oh, it's sex and violence.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, did you read what happened before? Like, and I think about that when students come in and say there's a swear word. I say, well, usually when someone swears, there's a reason, and then they go back, oh, yeah, that you're right, sort of thing. So if you sometimes think about that when people take that stuff out of the story and you say, yeah, that's in there, well, then that's what your mind is going to be all about, is that you're looking for that moment in the book so you can say, ah, there, that's it, as opposed to, is the overarching story, well, what's the theme? Well, what's the meaning behind this? You know, And so I sometimes, I wonder about that, because we'll read reviews and we'll read the book and we'll put it on the shelf and the students sign it out. And you have that moment where you're like, oh my gosh, they're going to find. And then you realize 5 kids have signed it out, or, you know, parents have seen it. And not one person has batted an eye because I haven't said that has sex and violence.
Right, right. Oh, so, no, I don't go around telling people that.
No, I know. But I just think about sometimes when we're advocating for things is that they've taken something out of isolation, and then you're like, oh, you've just taken a moment. You're not taking the whole big picture.
And it's always those close-minded parents who inadvertently, like, the book falls on the floor, and of course it opens the page. And it's like people are like, oh, I hate cats, but then the cats are all, like, you know, crawling all over them. What about the real reading discussion? I mean, are we past the real reading discussion, or is it still happening?
Oh, it's still happening.
Well, I want to ask a question of everybody in the room. Who is a romance reader? You can confess. Okay. Yeah.
It's a safe space. You can confess.
But think about, like, we're actually embarrassed to say, like, we're a romance reader, or, like, I really love sci-fi. Like, I am a member of a, like, sci-fi book club, and people are like, I think we put a lot of judgments on reading still, and we sort of, like, demarcate this is good and this is bad reading. Nobody sort of mocks you for a beach book, but I get mocked for, like, my fantastic space opera. I'm sorry. No. So I think it's part of a larger discussion around, I think, collections and literacy that we're sort of don't want to have with ourselves. And it makes people uncomfortable, actually. I mean, I took a long time before I was like, yeah, I really like nonfiction. I really like sci-fi. Mm-hmm. I like Can Lit, but I am not, like, I do not bleed for Can Lit in the way a lot of other people do. And I did not like... I did not like A Wrinkle in Time. I do not like that book. But, I mean, I think, again, like, there's a notion that if you're a literate person, it's like you have to like this particular canonical text, and, you know, there's good reading and there's bad reading, and there's all good reading. Scott, we've got a few questions from the audience. Do you want to take questions as we go, or do you want to save them? Yeah, let's
take questions. Is it both the talks that we're discussing?
Yes.
Okay, then we will take them. Yes, go ahead.
I can see obviously being easy for the literature people. They will get graphic novels and telling the story and reading. It's not the literature people I'm worried. There's going to be someone in my audience who's a business person or a science person going, yeah, what do you think?
There are graphic novels for science. Do you know about the graphic medicine community? They're fantastic. They're doing presentations here this weekend as part of TCAP. It's part of nurses training. It's part of, like, medical training. It's part of, like, empathy. Like, there is...
That's the answer I need. Yeah. And business? Anything for business?
Yeah, actually, there's some really fantastic business graphic novels. There's even, like, accounting. There was, like, the manga guide to insert whatever. Because think about really good business practice. It's like anything is good informational text. And the best way to relay informational text is using graphics. And there's quite a science doing that.
But, you know, also the like, surge that comics are having right now in the world is a business case of its own. Is a
yeah,
business case
very
of
good
own.
Point, yeah.
Right?
Nice. Yeah, the comics industry, I mean, I think that the comics industry in Canada is a great business case, period.
And using these, like, using comics, for example, to track how censorship leads to a boom in sales, like,
yeah.
You can use this one summer and look at, as soon as a book gets challenged, so many more people buy it. It's the best thing that could happen to you if you write a book.
Yeah.
That, like, yeah. And you can use, there are so many comic examples, these cases.
Now, I'm coming from a grade 6, 7, 8 middle school environment, and we're talking about real books, novels, versus graphic novels. What about the idea of balance? Asking students, you need to read something that's graphic, something that's prose, something that's fiction, something that's nonfiction. Is that something you would advocate, or would you just say read?
Well, that's how I created my diverse book list.
Yeah.
Was that whole idea, wasn't necessarily that you were looking for, you know, a person of color necessarily to make it diverse.
No.
But that the whole idea was that we make choices in what we read and be more diverse about where we go. And I think it goes back to the whole idea, you were talking about loving romance books, that you can't necessarily, like, so much as I enjoy a certain style of book, I can't read it all the time.
Mm, yeah.
And I think that's part of the roles that we're in as well, is to be open-minded and try to read diverse pieces. And you might not find the one that matches you at this time, but at least give it a try.
Because as a classroom, like I'm a teacher librarian, and I let kids read whatever they want, push that. But as a classroom teacher teaching literacy, I started off the year in grade 8 teaching graphic texts.
Yeah.
Because a lot of my kids don't want to read graphic texts. But once I get them reading it, some of them won't stop, mm-hmm. which is what I want them reading. Mm-hmm. But I also need them to be able to read paragraphs upon paragraphs of text mm-hmm. as well. Am I being a bad person by saying, can you choose something else for a change? Like, I'm not, I don't want to take the graphic text away.
I think it's a hard line.
Like, it's, that's what I mean.
Is most of the research out there says that the kids need to feel confident.
Yeah.
So, like, if they feel confident about their reading, and if they feel confident to ask questions about reading, that is the biggest indicator for success. I think sometimes in the classroom, it gets told to students in such a way that they, again, conceptualize graphic text mm-hmm. as they're othered. I was just at a summer reading meeting, and two of the summer reading programs in the outer areas, I'm not going to call them out, actually have rules, summer reading rules, and again, for summer reading, it shouldn't be about rules.
Yeah.
They can only read, every other book has to be a graphic novel, so they can't read just graphic novels. And I would say there's really strong evidence-based research that, again, just you should read what you want to read, how that people read for interest. I think the biggest thing is to cultivate interest, too.
And just in providing them with graphic texts that have become more
well,
complex.
Well, I would say, like, what are you really interested in? Like, you know, if somebody is reading graphic texts, you know, so many kids in your age group, they love Nathan Hale's Hazardous Tales.
Yeah.
You know, these are like true disaster tales.
Yeah, but
the Donner Dinner Party, one of my favorites, because I was obsessed with cannibalism.
Yeah.
So.
Romance and cannibalism.
Yeah. Yeah, I was a wide reader. My mom was an early literacy teacher, and she just let me read whatever. And she also let me read nonfiction books that were probably too hard for me, but I would, like, work my way through. And, you know, she didn't make restrictions on my reading. She gave me a lot of books and let me choose when I wanted to read the books. And I was attending a PD sessions, and they said the same. It's like, let people make choices. Provide them with, like, a great range of options.
And I was going to say, some of my favorite books always were the ones that had, like, prose and then a poem and then, you know, like comics and then a nonfiction piece.
But
I'm just saying, in terms of the choices, like, I think that even when I'm just trying to think of when I was doing my master's, you know, when you get the book that's been photocopied and it's been edited by the professor, sort of thing. But I think being really cognizant of doing something along that line is, as you're looking at what types of readings you want to have throughout the year, is that you try different things. Like, they're always, it's always random, so it's not always the same thing. And I know we're all readers, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a full book. It could just be a page or two on something. And it just gets them in the practice of, oh, I really like that. Oh, I didn't like that. Right? And so that was always my favorite. And then I always ended up reading it all, because I had read everything else like two or three times. And I was like, I'm going to read this about this plant now, because, you know, I can't read this comic anymore, because I know all the panels, I know what's happening. And so I'm just trying to think of, I would maybe do more of an edited curation and make sure that I have a variety of different things available to them. And it doesn't have to, as they say, have to be the big book or anything like that. It could just be an article.
Yeah. You know, can I say, I was always a reader, but my brother really struggled with reading. He struggled with learning to read, and then he hated reading. And then something happened to him, which was that this book was truly horrible, fell in his lap. It's called The Runaway Robot. It's by Lester Del Rey. It's a sci-fi book. It fell in his lap. He read it. It ignited a passion that now he's 30 years old, and he's one of the most voracious readers ever. Was that book a milkshake? For sure. If a book is a milkshake, that was one. But it did something to his brain. It made him fall in love. And I think that with kids, really, like, fostering love, for literature, love, and if they hate reading, finding that one thing. Well, maybe they're only interested in reading about cannibalism, and then and make it or whatever. You know, get them on the topic. I think it's the best thing. It's the best thing we can do for kids is to help them find that thing that's going to make them not only a reader but a researcher, because that is so much of it.
Yeah, it's feeding the research. So my whole thing with cannibalism is I love disasters, and like kids love disasters. So like I would often pair like Nathan Hales with I Survived books, which are historical fiction, and then I would do historical nonfiction with like the DK books, the DK Eliminous books, and then I would bring in like Woods Hole in Massachusetts that has a fantastic thing. They did all the Titanic excavations with underwater archaeology. I'd be like, oh, did you guys know there's this really cool site online? Mm-hmm. Or maybe have them write their own stuff. I mean, there's been a lot of great work with zines, and I think like having that participatory element, if like you really like reading graphic novels, well, try writing your own graphic novels, and they're practicing reading and writing skills.
I think parents are kind of the most resistant when it comes to graphic novels out of everyone. What are some sort of, what are your sort of buzzwords or buzz phrases, or you know, your little suitcase of things that you bring out to parents when they say, oh, I don't want my kid reading any more graphic novels? Like, do you have little bits of research that you like to throw at people? Or sort of mob at people?
Generally, yes. I mean, I love graphic medicine. Like, that I think is one of the most fascinating. And so there's also a narrative medicine community. And there's a lot of, you know, really great research out there. And I mean, I think art therapy in general has been around so long. Like, I think that's the other thing, is that when we talk about criticism towards graphic novels, we're basically talking about criticism towards an arts education. And I'm really tired of that. Like, why did we stop being creative as adults? Like, why did we get so dismissive of art? And why did we get so dismissive of being creative? And I think that's a really good discussion point to have with adults, is that, you know, there's such a great basis for the arts, period. And it's cross-cultural. That's the other thing, is I like to talk about reading in, like, Japan, or reading in Korea, or reading in France. And I'm like, the way we read graphic novels is only a North American thing. Like, you go to Korea, they have textbooks that are graphic novels for, like, all the different curriculum. Like, it could be math, it could be science. Everything, like the graphic novels. Jean Yang has great stories of like traveling in Asia and being like all the comic book shelves, and I think those are all really great examples. Or Jean Yang himself, who's a computer science teacher for 10 years, and he loves comics. It turned out okay.
I say multimodal literacy all the time, and I know nobody knows what I'm talking about when I say it, but doesn't that sound like a real thing?
Yeah.
And then I talk about how...
Oh, it sounds amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it is a real thing. It is a real thing. But I know that like when I'm talking to my friends who are parents, when I'm talking to other people, they don't know what this means, but then I talk about how... everybody does want to talk about literacy, of course. Like, literacy does not mean today what it meant when I was a kid. It just doesn't. Learning to read the way that I learned to read would be so irrelevant to people today. And it doesn't mean that they're worse readers. I tell them all the time that like my OCAD students are not necessarily like the most academically proficient students that go to any institution. We don't really have a scholarship program, so we're not Queens, like we're not UT, we just aren't that. We get students who have super weird ideas, I'll just say that, and who are totally brilliant. They're not like so academically inclined. These students can read like visual text that in a way that is so much more sophisticated than me and all of my like a 5 university degree. I'm like, they are smarter than I am in a way that really matters to today's economy. And then I just start crying.
Right
there.
Okay, that's a good one to
do. Literacy.
I find that sometimes with parents, they are looking at me as a librarian, as someone who's as a trusted authority. Mm-hmm. So if you say, no, this absolutely helps foster literacy, and again, saying, like, this book won an award, or, like, this is on this reading list, and just saying, like, no, this is a bunch of people recognize this as being a legitimate way to foster literacy. And sometimes I'll say, like, well, what if somebody told you you can only read this one kind of thing? And see, that doesn't really work a lot. And sometimes I'll say, well, what about when you were a kid? Did you, like... And I try that, but that doesn't always work.
Well, I was going to say there's a couple of things. I always make sure that there's a graphic novel or a comic on all of the book lists that we put out to the students. Like, it's always one of the choices with summer reading lists or recommended reading when we have a book fair. I also have to say that, this isn't a plug for Scholastic, but I have to say that I really appreciate this. In a school, the Scholastic book clubs are still really popular, and they promote graphic novels in selling to parents, right? Like, it's on the cover of the pamphlet that the kid brings home or the brochure saying, I want to get this book. So I have to say that it's not in the back pages. It's actually on the front page. And if their daughter, and I have them at an all-girls school, comes home and says, I want that book, you see them buying it. You know, when the delivery comes in, those brown boxes come in, and they're, and you see on almost all the desks of kids that have purchased something, there is a graphic novel in the mix. So you appreciate that as well, as that, you know, they're buying them as well for them because their children are interested in them. So I think in some ways, those types of things have helped as well promote them because they're everywhere.
I learned today that Scholastic is putting together their first of their own comic that they will be releasing, because they release for graphics, right? Mm-hmm. But they're like moving, Scholastic is moving right into the comics game. It's good for kids.
I always use the kids learn more rare words reading graphic novels than reading text. And they understand what those words mean because of visual support.
Yeah. That reminds me that this week I went to my daughter's kindergarten information night. More tears. And it was in the library, and there was a poster on the wall. I'm going to get them to take it down next year. And it said, remember the five-finger rule. If you get through the end of the book and you found five words you don't understand, the book is too hard for you.
First page.
I took the picture.
I
was like, and I was like, oh, my God. A, if I followed that rule, I would not have. Like, give me a break. Yeah. Like, my kid will sit through a book, if it's a comic, will sit through a book that has 100 words she doesn't understand, and she'll sit through it enough times that eventually she starts to understand it. And that's reading, folks. Yeah. Like, instead I'm a jerk. Mm-hmm. But, like, that to me, like, well, that's the best way to learn to read.
But that also is only, we're also preferencing narrative text by doing that, because nobody in the world can read a nonfiction text and only not recognize five words.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We've all read dinosaur books as a kid, right?
Yeah.
Right. So the five-finger rule is crap, basically. It is preferencing narrative reading, and we tend to preference narrative reading as adults. Kids actually don't. Like, a lot of kids are informational readers. I didn't even know how profound it was myself until I pulled some search stats, and, like, so, like, 75% of the information of the nonfiction checked out by teens and kids was informational text, but adults tend to read narrative nonfiction. So, I mean, think of it, like, we sort of are thinking of, like, their reading habits based on our own line of thinking and not necessarily how they actually read. Mm-hmm. And putting some restrictions on.
I think that's why, like, books like the Guinness World Book of
Records.
Any kind of record books.
Pretty soon.
10 minutes?
The next thing starts in 10 minutes.
So we've got some time for questions. We didn't really get through a lot of stuff, but I think we had a really great spirited conversation. So if there's anything that we did talk about that you want to hear about, now's your chance. Yes?
Do you have any recommendations about the webcomic recommendations? Is there like an aggregator that are grade specific that we could use in the classroom, rather than me having to sift through, read, and kind of it's relatively sanitized so the parents don't hit the roof?
I recommend you sift through and read them.
I intend to, but nevertheless, though, what are the recommendations?
I mean, specifically for webcomics or comics that are available digitally? I'm going to put a plug, and I didn't get a plug from them, but Hoopla has a really great service, and, you know, they just signed a deal with Marvel and Image, and I found that that's really nice, and it's a very seamless reading experience in the library, especially with Infinity War. Like, people are guiding that 4-year-old to Infinity War, it's funny, like, we're talking about comics being bad, and people are like, oh, my four-year-old, hey, Thanos, hey, you made Thanos. So I'm like, oh, your four-year-old wants to read The Infinity War? Hey, we have it streaming on, like, Hoopla, so you can download it. So I think that there's a lot of really good seamless reading experiences, and, you know, Scholastic and a lot of the educational providers have a lot more e-content that's available, so that's totally helps.
And that's accessible to the kids on their phones, is that right?
It depends. I mean, depending on the e-book app. There's so many different e-book services, and that's sort of a complicator, but Hoopla is one, Overdrive is another big one, and a lot of the educational providers also have that.
I think you should ask kids.
Yeah.
That's what I said in the panel this morning that I have my university students do like a show and tell every term. They have to bring in a comic and then give kind of a pitch for it, and they get marks for that. But they're like so passionate about doing this. Like if you ask a 10-year-old, well, like, what are your 5 favorite web comics? I bet they'll give you a list of 10.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they are. Kids are aggregators. Remember all the music you used to listen to when you were young? Yeah. I knew all the music. Now I know nothing.
I mean, the thing about webcomics, too, is that in their nature, they're kind of rebellious. I think that webcomics have kind of taken the place of sort of the underground comics of the 1960s, and that they're exploring ideas and stories that are not necessarily mainstream.
And images as well, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Porn.
And, well, I wouldn't go there, but...
Sexy?
I mean, yeah, definitely sexy, but usually fun sexy.
But there's so much good queer and also especially trans representation in webcomics because webcomics are not bound by the rules of who has access to the press, right?
And there's also an interesting thing happening, which is that a lot of webcomics are getting a print publication now. So there, you might also want to look into things like that started as webcomics that became...
Phoebe and Her Unicorn started as a webcomic?
I think so.
Yeah, so Phoebe and Her Unicorn, Dana Simpson. If you guys don't know, best comic ever. Like, it's updated Helen and Hobbes in some ways, but there's unicorns.
And sometimes they're still available, too, online in webcomic format. So there's also...
And Katie Ian started as a webcomic, too. So, I mean, a lot of Canadian webcomics out there, so, yeah.
Any other questions? Yes.
I just wondered what you call a non-graphic novel, because we get all sorts of, is it a book? Is it a real book? Is it a non-graphic novel? Have you found a word yet? I don't know if this is a dumb question, but when parents say, well, I want them to read a real book.
I say a prose text.
Okay.
Because also, I mean, there's, so then they want their kids to read poetry? Books of poetry?
Or
maybe you could say that. Oh, you mean poetry? You want to play? Oh, sorry.
And I guess my other question is, so what you're saying is it's fine for the kid who borrows the Diary of a Wimpy Kid books over and over for 2 years solid.
I think it's good.
And never branches out.
Because eventually they will get bored.
You do. Yeah, I read Nancy Drew like you would not believe.
You know,
I eventually got done, like I was finally done with her. And I'm not saying that I'm done because I can remember all the characters and all that. And it still makes me, like, have a little flutter in my heart. But I think they'll get past it eventually. And if not, you constantly are just saying, you know what, maybe we should try it. Like, I'm going to give you something else. Take the Diary of a Wimpy Kid, but can I give you something else to try
as
well?
And
they might say, no, I didn't even open it. But sometimes they come back and say, I actually didn't mind that.
You can also, in comics theory, when people are writing about comics, like in scholarly works, almost everybody talks about the importance of rereading and how that is one of the most productive and provocative, like, aspects of a comic text, that many of them actually build in the requirement to reread into the text itself. You get to the end, you have to turn back, or you get to a moment, and you have to turn back. Or even, I mean, I keep talking about Alison Bechdel today, but in Fun Home, she repeats panels with new information, the same image with new information, in order to sort of cause that. So, but it's part of the structure of the form.
I was just going to say, too, I know that the Ministry of Education Ontario is doing a lot of work with play, and especially K to, like, Division 1 schools, and, you know, there's a lot of discussion about adult-directed play and child-directed play. Reading is the same. Like, there should be a mix of adult-directed reading and child-directed reading, so
definitely talk to them about best practices, give them a lot of options, but let them pick what they want to read too. So just like you can't, you shouldn't, the best practices are don't overschedule your kid. Like, have your kid have, like, adult-directed play and child-directed play. Reading is the same. And I really gave my mom a lot of props afterwards. I told her after I went to this play workshop, and I was like, you did well.
There's always a great opportunity that if a book, like say the kid comes in and says, I want Diary of a Kid, the fourth one, I don't know the names of all of them, and because there's so many of them now, and you're like, oh, it's not in. However, you shouldn't go home without something to read tonight. So how about this? Timmy Failure, or, you know, trying to think of what other books are like that. The Loser List, or, you know, anything like that.
My life is a curtain.
And you just take it out, so it's always out?
Yeah. Hide the favorite book so you have to give them substitutes.
Yeah. Hide the dog man in the Minecraft.
All right, I guess that's the end. Thank you so much for coming.